Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I didn't hear you say McClure.
Because there's somebody talking to me. The computer's talking.
It is?
Yeah.
What was it saying?
It's better. It was some news site that I had open to report on. I don't really like the auto turn on videos that happen on news sites. It's like they don't want their news to be read in a work setting.
Yeah, I keep my speakers turned off unless I specifically want to listen to something.
Yeah, because they're just gonna
it's
get
very
in your
irritating
face.
To say the least.
Yeah.
So
listen. Yes, I will say McClure now if
okay.
You would like.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this February 3rd, 2018. Is anybody besides me astonished that it's February?
No more astonished than I am that it's Saturday.
Well, I mean,
which is to
it's
say
like
not.
January.
It's just it is.
It's kind of like I sneezed at some point and January was gone.
We'll stop sneezing. That's really discomforting for the rest of us. You sneeze and a whole month disappeared.
Well,
don't do that anymore.
That must have been what happened. That's all I can say. Anyway, the telephone number to call in here, if you would like to join with us on this Saturday, the 3rd of February 2018, and ask us any questions or make any comments about the economy or investing or anything of that nature or ilk, is 254-773-1400, and we'd love to have a call. We got a round number on calls last year of zero. I told you.
You sneezed and a year went by. We just had an hour, and wow, stop sneezing. It's very difficult to keep up with history when it just disappears.
It's global warming. you blame everything on global warming.
Right.
Anyway, we didn't have any calls last hour, I guess. Maybe nobody was listening.
We are so interestingly boring.
One of the things,
everyone falls asleep to the dulcet sound of our voices talking.
Dulcet sound?
Yeah, it's very dulcet, or at least rumbly.
Anyway, back when the S&P 500 passed 2,500, I said that's, it's kind of a mark. You can say, look at there, 2,500. If it's above 2,500, it's higher than it was back then. Of course, it is well above that. And then it kept on going through 26 and so on. But
we're talking about the S&P, although the Dow has been the thing that people have talked about. The S&P's up above 27. It's 2,762 now.
And practically nobody noticed when it went through 2,700. 27,000,
We had the 27. 500 for the S&P. It's 27,000.
That's why it's 27,000 for the Dow. You know, I remember at 20,000 it was a big deal, and at 25,000 it's a big deal. I guess it'd be 30,000 before it's another big deal.
This is something that caused a lot of people to be shocked at us a few years back. We made some predictions. Do you remember them?
Yeah, we predicted very regularly that the sun would appear to rise in the east the following day.
But in 2015, when we were going through that correction, we made some predictions on what to expect for the Dow Jones Industrial Average into the future. And we said some things like, don't be surprised if in 2016, 2017, we hit 25,000. And people were...
And here we are.
They were looking at us like we were insane. Well, we're down to 25,500 at this point. So we were... The predictions that we're making, by the way, we're not patting ourselves on the back because
we were
so absolutely brilliant. It's just we're looking at what has happened in history when we have good economies. It's not difficult to understand, except we had just been coming from a bad economy. When you come from a bad economy to a good economy and you make a glowing prediction, people go, whoa, you're insane. That's never going to happen. And when we're in a good economy and we say that bad economies happen, people say, ah, you're insane. You're just being pessimistic. Well, bad economies happen too. And we've got to do everything that we can now to prepare in the good times for when bad times come, because they do.
Yep.
Hopefully we have a good cycle of bad, good going off into the future forever. Because if not, history tends to prove that you don't get stuck on the good side of the cycle forever. If you're going to get stuck on a cycle part, it's the bad side. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I missed the first hour, so you touched on this.
You didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
Thursday in the Dallas Morning News, Alan Greenspan said there's irrational exuberance in both the stock market and the bond market. What is irrational exuberance in the bond market?
Did you say irrational or rational?
No, irrational. He said irrational in the stock and bond market.
Okay.
I don't know what an irrational bond market looks like. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
The one that that existed before last week was an irrational bond market.
Right. What we've been saying about the bond market for probably 4 years now is that people are buying into it at a overpriced cost with the expectation of safety. When they're buying it for more than the face value, it's going to mature for less than they paid for it. And people are dumping money into it anyway because they see it as safe. When you pay more for something than you're going to get paid for it, we call that irrational. And they do it out of exuberance in looking for safety. And that's what we've seen in the bond market up till now. Irrational. Well, let's define what is exuberance. Exuberance is buying, or in this case, buying with a passion beyond the logic. And if you're just, if we want to look at a really good example of irrational exuberance, what we've seen in the bond market is a minor form of that up till recently. What we saw in the Bitcoin market is a major form of that. People were buying something where they didn't know what the value was or why it was going up. It just was going up and it was very exciting, and so they were buying it. We're going to get there again in the stock market. There is definitely some optimism coming in. But the fact that we still get calls that say that there's too much exuberance or that it's irrational now is a good sign for the stock market. I think the stock market's probably fairly priced right now. It could do with a correction, but not because it's drastically overpriced. There are definitely parts of the market that are way over the top priced, but the majority of the market is running at about its historical average when it comes to earnings to price. That's something to hang on to. The average when it comes to interest rates and premium payments versus discount payments on bonds, we were very definitely into the what in the world are you doing? You are irrationally buying something with a guaranteed loss on it. Why are you doing that? Well, because it's safe. Well, I really don't know how to respond to that. If you have a guaranteed loss, how is that safe? And that's irrationality writ large. We're going to get into that with the stock market. When the bull market is really mature, we get headlines that say, put all your money in XYZ stock, whatever it may be, because it's going up like crazy. We still see some ads for that, but it's not the headlines. Headlines start saying it. And those of you that remember 2000, the year 2000, when they were talking about the dot-coms, that was absolutely irrational exuberance. If you think back to the year 2006, when we were talking about collateralized mortgage obligations, that is the reason why we had the recession. We were saying there is exuberance here. This is irrational. People are buying things when they know that the payments will not be made. They absolutely have to know it. They're the ones that signed the contract. They know that the person that signed it on the other side is not going to pay it. When we were saying it then, we were called pessimists. When throughout the recession, we were called optimists. Now we're beginning to be called mild pessimists again. And it started this year. Last year, we were still pretty optimistic long term. Short term, we're extremely optimistic. Long term, we've got some problems we have to deal with that are not being dealt with. The way you deal with those problems, unfortunately, is by bringing attention to it. The only way you bring attention to problems is by, one, you got to recognize the problem, and that only happens after a big financial hit. That's just the way it goes. We didn't make the reforms necessary for the collateralized mortgage obligations until after they went bust. We should have done them before it went bust. But it takes a financial hit to get people's attention.
I just looked up. Dallas Morning News was quoting Alan Greenspan on Bloomberg, and in Bloomberg, what he mentioned in passing that he thought there was a stock market bubble and a bond market bubble, but then he went on at great length and he said that the bond market bubble is dangerous, the bond market issue. And the reason, he said, very simply, the United States government is headed towards a massive revenue shortfall. It will be, same thing we've been saying, it will be borrowing a tremendous amount of money at ever higher interest rates going forward. And this is the thing that, frankly, there's two issues that concern me right now.
But first, let me throw in something, okay, because I looked it up too, and the leading line is that the bond market bubble will eventually be a critical issue. And then it says, the man who made the term irrational exuberance famous. It's true.
If he didn't use the term irrational exuberance.
No, he didn't use it here. It's being thrown in there. The words irrational exuberance were not used by Greenspan talking about the market right now.
And if you read the entire interview or listen to it, because it's actually just a transcript of what he said, I completely agree with him. It's not just that we have an overpriced bond market at the moment. It's that the massive revenue shortfalls that the government is going to see because of the tax bill that the Treasury is already announcing are going to happen will result in the Treasury beginning to accelerate the borrowing of money just as interest rates start to rise from historic lows. And frankly, there is a serious danger here.
And it's already happening right now. January 31st, the Treasury Department announced that it's raising the size of its 3, 10, and 30-year debt sales. It's making it bigger than it's been since the recession.
And here's the danger.
That means they're borrowing more.
Biggest borrower in the world, individual borrower, is the United States, which means the United States borrowing can affect interest rates and does affect interest rates. If we get higher interest rates, and I almost want to say when, because it's an almost given that interest rates are going to go up just because of the laws of supplies and demand.
Right. The big things are Medicare and Social Security are still there, which means we have to keep paying them, and the prices are going up for that.
here's the issue that we run into. As the United States bar is the United States Secretary Mnuchin didn't want to do this, but the White House overrode him, and all the advisors in the White House basically shut him down. He is borrowing short term. In other words, he's borrowing at the 2 and 3 year point,
which is really not a smart. If you were a company doing that, your shareholders would be screaming at you.
We should be borrowing long term, but the problem with borrowing long term, I mean, if interest rates are at record or near record lows, you want to borrow money for as long as you can at those record lows. But somewhere 2 to 3, very frankly, and this I've read from insider reports from Washington, from the commentators that are not political. They're just simply saying, here's the strategy. By keeping the borrowing short term in 2 to 3 year notes, the impact on interest rates, long-term interest rates on things like mortgages and so on, won't be felt for 2 to 3 years when the government refinances all these notes when they come due in 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. And
that'll
that's
be
important.
On the other side of the 2018 elections.
This is important. All of the notes that, you know, they're doing 30-year bonds again, which is something they stopped for quite a while. They're not doing a lot of them. Most of it is concentrated on the short-term stuff. And people say, well, that's good. Short-term is great. We just get it all paid off, except that we're not paying it off. We're refinancing it. And we're going to have, I mean, this is another prediction just based on looking around. Interest rates are much more likely to be up in 3 years than they are today, higher yep. than they are today, which means that we're going to refinance at a higher rate for a longer period of time.
The objective, and this has not only been stated by people in the White House, it's stated by congressional Republicans who said the issue is to give everybody a tax cut this year, not have the impact hit until after the congressional elections. But here's the problem. We're thinking a little further down the road, and here's the issue. As the refinancing of this stuff goes on, it will go on at ever higher interest rates. And the more borrowing that occurs, the higher the interest rates get. And the higher the interest rates get, the more the deficit will grow because we've got to pay the interest rates, which means we'll have to borrow more to pay the higher interest rates, which will raise interest rates, causing us to borrow more.
This is what happened very, very clearly, an example of what happened in the late 70s when we talk about that stagflation era under Carter. Some people listening weren't around during that time period. I was around. I was just not old enough to really understand it. We studied it. Well, when you have lots of borrowing that starts off short term and then you refinance for a longer term and it causes the interest payments to be more expensive and it tends to cause the economy to do a slowdown. It causes taxes to go up. It causes them to get more complex. And that's kind of leads to this next thing. We were promised something in the election. We were promised a tax cut. That's fantastic. We got a tax cut. But part of the promise was that we were going to simplify the tax code, which was more important in our minds than the tax cut itself. Because the amount of money that's being paid to do taxes, the number of hours that is being taken to do taxes, just dropped because we've got some things that have happened in the individual rate that are going to disappear. It's already written into the law. It's going to disappear in 2025. We've made the tax code more complex, which means it's going to cost more to do your taxes. Much less the other side of the equation, which is the taxes are going to go back up in 2025. Just to give some really clear-minded business pointers, when you're making more money as a company, if you've got a small business and you're making more money than you ever have, the idea during that time period, if somebody comes to me as a client and they say, I'm making more money than I've ever made before, I tell them, sock away some of that money. Don't take on more debt. Pay off the debt when you can. Because the idea is, in boom years, you get your reserves that allow you to make it through the bust years. Because they happen. Anybody that's ever had a business will tell you, no matter how good the company is, no matter how good the business is, there are times when it's hard, where you have to take on debt. If as a government, we took that same advice and we paid down the debt in the boom years. Don't lower the prices on your products. You're already making record, by the way, just as a side note, last year was an absolute record amount of revenue to the government. It was also a lot of debt, but we had more revenue to the government as a round number than we've ever had before. And we look at that. That should be the time, if you're fiscally conservative, if you are business oriented, where you say, all right, now let's pay down some of this debt so that the next time we have rough times, we can take on debt again if we need to, or maybe we'll just have a rainy day fund. For those of you that are interested in this, that's what Texas does. Texas has a rainy day fund. It's time to start restoring that rainy day fund because we dipped into it during the recession. And if those of you that were here during the recession recognize that Texas didn't get hit as hard as the rest of the country. We didn't have debt as a state. We had a rainy day fund to step in and help. We had the ability to lure businesses that were having tough times elsewhere to come to Texas at a discounted rate. That's what we use the rainy day fund. The U.S. government is not doing that. And the majority of people that listen to this program live in Texas, and they're all for not having debt at the state level, and they're all for having a rainy day fund until we start talking about lower taxes at the federal level. And then they say, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do that. That's called a dichotomy, by the way, just as a side note. Dichotomy means to hold completely opposing ideas in your brain at the same time comfortably. We are comfortably holding this idea of we live in Texas, it's got no income taxes, it's got the sales tax, and no debt.
I think you're referring to cognitive dissonance.
It's cognitive dissonance, but the dichotomy is cognitive dissonance writ large, only it is comfortable. Usually dissonance is uncomfortable. Dichotomy means you've got comfort in holding these two completely opposing ideas at the same time. And that's what we're looking at. Most fiscally conservative people, doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Independent, doesn't matter. They look at a business and they would make a decision. And when they look at the government, they're going to make a different decision.
Let's changing the subject just a little bit. We mentioned this last week, but we had some new news this week. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if today is February 3rd, 2018. Long-term care insurance payouts increased 6% in 2017. Yeah, you say, well, big deal. The problem is that rate of increase has been accelerating over the past several years. The planned increase by the actuaries from years ago, and I remember this from years ago because I used to be in the insurance industry and have some idea what was going on, was maybe a 3 to 4% increase per year, the maximum that they planned on. And what happened is there's a couple of things, and it may be higher than that because there are certain linked products that weren't considered. For instance, there's some forms of life insurance and some forms of annuities that have long-term care insurance associated with them as part of their cost,
right?
And that didn't get counted. This is just the pure long-term care insurance. The expenditure by insurance companies went up 6% last year. That is unsustainable. To give you some idea, that means in about 9 years, they are already, generally speaking, not profitable. The biggest long-term care insurance company in the United States, Genworth, was sold to a Chinese holding company last year because General Electric figured out that the thing couldn't do anything but lose money, and then General Electric had a $9.5 billion write-off on reinsurance on Genworth this year.
By the way, write-off means loss. It means they wrote it off as a loss.
So people come to us pretty regularly and say, should we go buy long-term care insurance? And there is a narrow slice of people who theoretically it might be good for, but I can also say the chances of any given company still being in business 10 years from now, right now, tend to be pretty slim. And as a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that 10 or 11 years from now, I would not be at all surprised to see a wholesale failure of long-term care insurance across the board, and at such a level that the state insurance guarantee funds might not be able to cover it. So the issue is, insuring for long-term care is only affordable at this point by the people who can afford to pay for their own long-term care.
Right, and this is the same kind of subject coming forward. Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and J.P. Morgan just got together. They teamed up on starting a healthcare company.
Right, to take care of their 500,000 employees.
Because they're absolutely frustrated with what's available out there. They cannot get their rates. Their rates are going up, just like everybody else's, at 20 and 30% a year. That is absolutely not sustainable.
And it was interesting that the healthcare companies that do the insurance and actually provide health care in some cases, across the board had from 7 to 11. This is what started the downturn in the market, by the way. They had between 7 and 11% drop in their share prices as soon as this announcement occurred.
Right.
And very frankly, our health care industry is so structured, and it's a political decision, to structure it in such a way that the companies providing health care for profit, and the companies that are providing the medications for the health care and the equipment for the health care are earning, obscene profits. And obscene meaning, considering the fact that they are taking the money from sick people. If you go to any of the major healthcare companies that are publicly traded and look at their profit margin, look at their earnings, it's mind-boggling, the quantity of money, the quantity of profit that they earn each year. Their stock prices look really, really good, and it's been a great sector to invest in because they have huge profits. But it is also the thing that is eating, I love what Warren Buffett said about it. He said it's the tapeworm that is eating the life out of American corporations. It's also the largest single expense of the United States government. And the Congress said, when it comes to Medicare and the prescription drug care benefit, that is forbidden Medicare or in the process of purchasing medications for people and negotiating other things to negotiate lower prices with healthcare providers.
United
just doesn't make any sense.
Their earnings doubled over the year before.
United Healthcare?
Yeah, and that's a statement. When you're raising rates by 20 and 30% and your earnings are doubling every year, and we're kind of shouldering that, when they don't have to compete, we've just established monopolies that it doesn't matter which company you go to. They're all with this monopoly mentality because they don't have to negotiate on prices. If you don't have to negotiate on prices, there's a real problem with that. We would like to negotiate on prices. So I mean, insurance theory is pretty clear. If we're all going to get sick at some point, and some of us are going to get sicker than others, and we have insurance, the insurance needs to pay for all of those sicknesses, which means we have to average all those costs out amongst a lot of people, which works fairly well if you've got a small group of people that get together and they say, we're going to put a bunch of money together and we're going to pay towards our medical expenses together from this pool. The problem is that when you hire someone to come in and manage that money and you pay them a significant portion of that money just to hold on to it and do the average numbers for people's insurance. If we pay them 20% of the costs, which is what we're doing, there's a 20% payment to the company for managing that pool. Don't be surprised when they want more money later, and so they keep charging you more, and their part keeps going up. Anyway, we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Frank, and I've been listening to you folks for years, and I think I've learned an awful lot. But I have for years also disagreed with you that the president, you know, it doesn't have any effect on the economy.
Really?
I mean, I've ordered new equipment. A lot of people have. The attitude of business people is just better when you say lower regulations and lower taxes.
Have you actually can I ask the question? Have you actually seen your regulations decline?
Some. The regulations that, for instance, EPA, the EPA's backed off some of the regulations, but the state hasn't.
Let me address something else. I totally agree with what you're saying. You're seeing something very specific to you and to the people that you know. But there's a little bit of an echo chamber, because this is important to recognize. There are business people out there, just think Silicon Valley, who are much more comfortable with a Democrat in office. So they tend to spend more when a Democrat's in office. So when we look at the overall nature of the economy, not specific, because you're absolutely right, a president, whether Democrat, Republican, Green Party, Libertarian, doesn't matter, if they're in office, they make the people that voted for them feel better. But we haven't had a landslide election in a very long time. And when you have a landslide election, like Ronald Reagan, when he went up for re-election, had a landslide. And that had a big impact on the economy, because his popularity was very high and we were winning the Cold War. We could see it. That caused the businesses to boom. But it's an attitude that when we talk about, for instance, old Baldy across from me, Jeff, just said, have you seen regulations improve? What we've seen is the promise of it, and in some cases, some minor regulatory improvements, but not enough to make the purchases that you've made just with the facts. You're making the purchases based on an attitude, and it's a great thing. Don't get me wrong. The president can affect short-term with a speech, can affect your attitude, which can affect your confidence.
And I will say to you, your Section 179, you bought a lot of equipment this year. Is that what you're saying?
I've actually ordered last year.
Okay. And there's clearly the psychological effect. But when we look at what presidents do, first off, presidents don't pass bills through Congress. Congress does.
Right.
Yeah, the president can obviously veto it, but they don't do that very often.
And the reason why Congress passed this particular law was because the president said do it.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no question that in the short term, and we've said this over and over again, this particular tax cut is going to be stimulative to the economy. The problem is that we're packing all the stimulus into a very short period of time with a massive multiplied payoff down the road that will hurt the economy. So if you and the folks at JP Morgan, I happen to agree with what they said, what you're going to see, and I hate to make predictions about interest rates, but I'm going to make one here. You're going to see in the not very far distant future interest rates go up. So if you want to borrow money to buy a piece of equipment, you're going to have to pay a lot more interest than you would have before.
And this is important to recognize. I'm going to throw this in now, because we were predicting this for Clinton or for Trump. Interest rates were going to come up. So the thing that triggers it is almost irrelevant. Interest rates, when they're at record lows, they've only got really one direction that they historically go, and that's up. So when we say long-term effect of this, what's happening is we've got a short-term boost, and we're trying to look really long-term. As we said before, you've got to lay the groundwork for an economy. Just like your business, the purchases that you made, you're laying the groundwork for higher profitability later. When the government is doing it the opposite way, when they're laying the groundwork for a lot of boost right now, but not so good later, it feels good, but it isn't good. It's like eating a bowl of ice cream for dinner.
You're either in manufacturing or mining, I would guess. Is that a fair guess?
Yes.
Okay, and the reason I say that is you look at the numbers, your sector of the economy has taken off like gangbusters since the president was elected. No doubt about it. And in certain areas in the economy, a given president, by choosing to enforce strictly or basically turn his head the other way, can make some big differences. The issue is whether the entire economy, whether the president gets the credit for an economic boom or a not economic boom. I mean, it's like the hiring, the number of hiring and the percentage hiring and so on. And again, I'm not knocking President Trump here at all, but I am saying that he took credit for a lot of things in the State of the Union. He misstated things just a little bit, because actually the hiring increases in the number of hires in the 2 years before he was elected are higher than the year than they were last year.
And let's go clear back. You say you've listened to us for years. When Obama was elected, he caused a boom in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But when you look at the overall economy, the whole economy wasn't growing at that rate. If you look at Bush, there was a boom in other areas. If you look at Clinton, there was a boom in other areas. There's positives and negatives associated with each president, but the overall average is not substantially changed.
You know, you bring up Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Now, Tim Cook of Apple, no doubt in my mind, he's a donating Democrat. But there's no doubt in my mind also that he made the decision to bring back $350 billion because of the opportunity to do so at a low tax rate.
Right. Well,
so,
you know,
so I can't figure out why they are so, you know, let's vote for a Democrat and higher taxes and this, that, and the other. And Democrats do not. You can argue that Bill Clinton did that, but in 95 or something. But Newt Gingrich made him balance the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know whether who gets credit for it, I don't know, but I really that's a very important point that you just made. Newt Gingrich was the daddy of the Balanced Budget Act, which this Congress,
has
led by the same party, basically voted to set aside.
That it wasn't basically. It was exactly what, I mean, total, they voted as a voice vote to not look at that, to use different rules than the ballots, than the Balanced Budget Act.
And I personally, I don't, the president has a bully pulpit. When you have a president that is popular either among a group of people or among, or in the whole nation, the economy tends to do better because he gives us an optimism, and I feel better about it. And hey, I love the fact that I got effectively a 28% tax cut.
Yeah, I've got a big tax cut too. That makes me feel good.
But
we're certainly doing more for our business based on the tax cut than we would have been.
And
but we also recognize that if we don't hang on to some of this, that the long-term logistics to the government is that they cannot borrow $1 trillion a year into the future. We will bankrupt ourselves. So that's where we are. This feels good. Don't eat all the ice cream. Save some of it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we've instructed our business manager to take our tax savings and put it in a savings account.
Yeah.
Because we're going to have to pay it back.
At some point, the piper has to get paid. And so when we're talking about this, and a lot of times, it's kind of funny because I mentioned it this episode as well. We get people that say, you guys are so optimistic or you guys are so pessimistic, and they're talking about the same episode. We get people that say, you guys are so conservative, and then at the same time, other people saying, you guys are so liberal. What we're trying to do is parse the politics completely out of it and say, if there is a person that is in a leadership role in our country, the president, that gets up and says good things and then follows through with those good things, it has a long-term benefit. When we have someone that says short-term things, that is very clearly short-term things, then we should expect a boost short-term. But the long-term stuff has not really been touched. We still have entitlement programs, Medicare, Social Security, that are going to go bankrupt. We've got a prescription drug care
cost-benefit problem. We've got the Obamacare issue has not been solved. There are these massive issues over to the side that we've attempted to work on this year, but not in a cooperative, bipartisan way. There's too much of a we did it, you didn't do it mentality of the credit goes to us and not to you, or vice versa. If we don't get together and seriously take on these issues, these real problems that are in the background, as long as we're dealing with the icing on the cake instead of the fact that we've got rotten fruit inside it, we've got a real problem, because that icing tastes great, but we're going to bite that fruit eventually.
Let me, and I'd just like to throw one other thing in about Apple. You dig into the details of what's going on at Apple. They, before the tax cut, before the change in the tax law, were spending $55 billion a year reinvesting in the United States. What they said was that over the next 5 years, they will bring back $275 billion. They will invest $275 billion in the United States over the next 5 years.
That's fantastic.
You take $55 billion, which is what they were spending before the tax cut, and you multiply that times five.
You get the same number.
Apple is doing a wonderful public relations job of saying, look how patriotic we are, look how wonderful we are.
They're doing their job perfectly.
But we're
point.
Going to be spending precisely the same amount of money that we were spending before the tax cut in the United States.
The difference, though, and this goes to you, caller, the difference is that the money that they had overseas, that they've had accumulated overseas, is getting taxed.
Yeah,
this year. They're paying the
right.
taxes.
They paid $38 billion in taxes on it.
And that's huge. The fact that we are borrowing $1 trillion this year, it would have been $1 trillion plus if we didn't get that money back.
Yeah, the real impact, by the way, and we've said this before, of the tax cut will hit the government next year. Because of the fact that we got to tax a lot of old overseas money we previously didn't tax, despite the fact that we're going to have to borrow an extra $500 billion this year, which, if you think about this just a minute, the numbers don't add up. If this thing's only going to cost $1.5 trillion, and we had to borrow $500 million more just this year, the numbers don't quite up anyway.
And this caller, I want to first thank you for calling in and challenging us, because there have been some folks that have done that in the past and they haven't done it very nicely. I appreciate the fact that you've been listening, although it doesn't speak well to your sanity to haven't been listened to us for that long. But the idea of the president, if you think of a president as the captain of a ship, it's not a really good analogy, because people would say it takes a long time to turn the Titanic. The president doesn't have the helm. There's a massive committee of people at the helm, and the president is trying to rouse the crew and the passengers on the ship to say, we need to turn to port or we need to turn to starboard. The effectiveness in the president doing that causes the committee at the helm to change the direction. And we have been, for about 8 years on a lot of subjects, with no clear direction. Well, we're getting some clear direction in certain areas, but less clear in others. So the president has an impact, but they have to be focused and consistent to make that impact last.
Right.
So, and by the way, thank you for investing in the economy. I guess you're hiring more people, too?
I intend to, haven't yet.
I mean, you got to hire people to operate all that new equipment.
Well, replacing some.
Oh, okay.
I actually met you guys one time down in Georgetown.
Oh,
sorry about that.
You survived that?
At Marlene's house. And I'm sorry I didn't get an autograph.
Well, I appreciate, as only people like us who have been self-unemployed for, in my case, 35 years, I appreciate something that I don't like. Let's say something nasty about the Democrats. They tend to think that making a profit, at least Elizabeth Warren does, is somehow sinful, and doesn't recognize that all the people you employ and all the people that we employ are the people who pay the taxes.
Right.
We pay the taxes.
Exactly.
And
when Obama says,
run, and it irritates,
you didn't build that.
He didn't say that. Warren did.
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren.
Obama said it as well.
He did?
Yeah. Okay. You didn't build those roads. Well, it wouldn't have happened without our tax money.
I beg to differ. It was my money that went to build those roads.
Yeah. And we've got to play some commercials. Thanks for the call. We really appreciate it.
Keep up the good work, and thanks for listening.
All right, we've got some commercials to play. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us, the number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You didn't McClure.
I didn't. I was busy taking the bagpipers out.
So multitasking is not high on your list. Anyway, the telephone number in here is 773-1400. We only have about 20 minutes left. We have 8 minutes left in
Less
the hour.
Than,
seven minutes left.
Minutes.
Six, 28 five,
or 7.
4, 3. No.
I wish the budget for the wall were going down instead of up. It started at 8 billion. Now it's at 20 billion. And it makes it really hard to guess.
The last negotiation was 25 billion. Trust fund set aside 20. By the way, again, being critical of President Trump, not because we're critical of President Trump, but because I think it's a good idea to ask questions. One of the things that came out that in Alan Greenspan's speech on or his interview on Bloomberg is he said he was a little surprised. If you add up all the things that the president wanted to do
in the State of the Union address,
he said, but there's no mention of where we get the revenue to do them. They're not currently in the budget. It's one of those things that typically he said, and I think this is based on my perhaps faulty memory, true. When a president comes out and says he wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, for example, he also says, here's how we'll raise the revenue to do that. And in this particular case, it didn't happen, which, by the way, in my opinion, given the difficulty in getting a budget passed of any kind,
yeah,
the infrastructure is sort of dead, and $25 billion for the wall is sort of dead because of a very simple thing. You can't get a spending bill with no money to support it through Congress without a supermajority vote. And I don't think they're going to get a supermajority vote to spend a bunch of money with no revenue to support it.
I'm going to throw in some good news here on the technology and medical front, because we've been talking about lots of problems. We've been talking about optimism for the short term. Here's some optimism for the long term. Even though we do have these other financial catastrophes looming out there, Stanford this week just published a paper based on a rat study that they were doing.
What study?
A rat. Rats, like as in the rodents.
Good.
And it's recently been shown that cancer is caused by scientists
by rats.
So rat cancer is caused by scientists. So stay away from scientists. But for real, this, on to the actual story. There's a vaccine that's been administered in rat studies that has been, so far, 100% successful against a whole series of cancers. You don't hear the word 100% and successful together with cancer studies almost ever.
Mm.
And they're beginning human trials on this. They're injecting two immune-stimulating agents directly into solid tumors, and it's having an impact on tumors and metastases in other parts of the body that are completely unrelated, because it's causing the body to recognize the cancer as a foreign object.
As we close out the hour, let me give you some good news. And it kind of reflects what the caller was talking about. This is from economy.com. In the fourth quarter, manufacturing sector labor productivity increased 5.7%. That's big. Manufacturing output, which includes mining, increased 7.3%, and hours worked rose 1.5%. That's the largest quarterly increases in manufacturing productivity and output since 2010, as we were coming out of the Great Recession. So we have manufacturing in the United States is doing its thing. We're seeing a pretty dramatic increase in manufacturing orders. We're seeing increase in shipments. And we're seeing a really big increase over the last year, and it kind of took place. We saw the actual output kick up at the end of the fourth quarter. We're not seeing manufacturing hiring a tremendous amount of people. I mentioned earlier, previous shows, that manufacturing hiring is up. It's not up as much as their output by any stretch of the imagination. But we are seeing a manufacturing renaissance in the country right now, pretty much across the board. We're also seeing a tremendous amount of durable goods purchases in the manufacturing and mining areas in the United States, which is generating this productivity. And if you, as I do, see the core of what we do, if we don't do any manufacturing, nothing else works, in my opinion. It really looks good down at the core of the economy, and it very well may be, and I'm just going to say this, it very well may be that a lot of the owners of manufacturing companies really wanted to see the environment, the regulatory burden lifted. We've seen the regulatory burden lifted, only in our cases it was by the courts, not by the Labor Department. The Labor Department was trying to crack down on some things, and several other or federal agencies were cracking down on some things that made employing people and made doing business much more difficult. Didn't make anything better for our clients. It just made life a lot harder for us and a lot less productive. And a lot of that has gone away. And again, it's the courts that have won.
Yeah, one big area that happened right at the end of the Obama administration was that people that worked a certain number of hours were taken away from or fell below a certain pay scale, were taken out of the salary pool and put into an must be hourly paid pool, which causes a whole series of new types of cost to appear in businesses.
Yeah, and we basically were forbidden to pay people if they took a day off.
Right.
Because they're not working.
Because they didn't clock
in. Working by the hour. And we just basically pay people a flat pay. And if they need to take time off to be with their kids or whatever, we just let them take time off and continue to pay them.
And that's one of the regulatory issues that the Trump administration and the courts pushed back against for good reason. And we're about out of time for this week.
Trying to put some balance in there.
Yeah. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have locally a voicemail waiting at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number at 1-800-914-7526. We are the Personal Wealth Coach, and we offer fiduciary investment advice to people that need it. If you want to go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, you can read our newsletter, listen to podcasts. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.